Florida is not exactly the biggest travel destination in the month of August, but we like to take the road less traveled here. Today on the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a university diversity officer who's taking on new duties.
Never in a million years did I think alligators came with student affairs.
We'll also hear about a tuition guarantee at a state university, a mental health mandate, and spend an academic minute saving coral reefs. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is the Best of Our Knowledge. Colleges and universities across the country are discovering the value of having a diversity officer on campus. At the University of West Florida, that officer is Dr. Kim LaDuff, and this summer she's been the one diversifying. She has taken on the roles of Vice President for Academic Engagement and Student Affairs for the school's Pensacola campus. I spoke with Dr. LaDuff about her new roles in some new departments at the university.
Essentially, the Division of Academic Engagement, which was founded about 2 years ago, was brand new. I was the founding vice president for that division. And I would say that division truly, you know, it was sort of in response to the work that we were doing with the metrics. We found that by having that division, we were bringing together a lot of the important units that support students and also encourage high-impact learning. So meaning that we're creating opportunities for students to get real-world experience, whether that's through study abroad, internship opportunities, even in the classroom, having real-world experience in the classroom. And so I've been working with the Division of Academic Engagement for 2 years, and we had the departure of Vice President for Student Affairs, Enrollment in Student Affairs. And so I took the Student Affairs piece. And it's actually a very nice match because, again, Student Affairs units are involved with conduct, with the student experience on campus, so whether that's through housing or student involvement. And so a lot of those units worked very closely with my units, such as advising and some of the programs that we have for special populations. So it's been a really nice union.
And you also work with student diversity, right?
That is correct. That's how I got my start here at University of West Florida. So initially, I came in as Associate Vice Provost for Equity and Diversity and International Affairs. Quite honestly, it's the work that I did there that really sort of shaped the work that I've done beyond with some of the support units. You know, when you think about those units, a lot of the work that we do is acclimating students to a new environment. So in our case, it's a university environment, but also helping them to feel part of the community. And, you know, by doing that, you're educating them, you're helping them to develop soft skills, you're helping them to create awareness about what resources are available to them on campus to support them. And you're helping them just connect with one another. And so if you think about, you know, some of the work that we do with student affairs and even with academic engagement, we're really helping students find those resources and learn how to navigate sort of the, you know, spoken and unspoken rules on a university campus.
Is it a little tougher job to do when you're dealing with so many commuter students as opposed to students who live on campus?
It's a combination. We have to be creative. Quite honestly, even with the traditional student population, you know, these are Generation Z students, and they are looking for something very different than students were looking for when I was going to college, and even, I would say, 5 or 10 years ago, in terms of the level of involvement. You know, this is a generation who grew up with cell phones and technology. They don't really like to engage face-to-face all the time, so we have to be very creative in terms of how we engage them on campus. Also, with commuter students, yeah, it is a little more difficult because they're not based on campus. So in terms of programming, we really have to think about ways to encourage them to get involved and to attract them to utilize the resources available.
What are some of the things that you see as being important for developing a student body as a community? How can you bring them together?
You know, in this day and age, it's really important to think about ways to encourage them to get involved face-to-face. I think our student organizations, one of the things that I love about UWF is we have lots of student organizations already, but if a student has an interest and can't find that on campus, you know, they tell them at orientation, get 7 friends and a faculty advisor and you can make it happen. And so I think a lot of times students come together around issues, ideas, and communities that they may have been affiliated with even before they come here, but this is an opportunity to really engage and really make a difference in some way. I also think that, you know, for students who are, they have a goal. They come here usually with a professional goal. They want to be employed. And so a lot of times they gravitate to others who have similar interests and may want to work with one another on, you know, developing mentoring relationships, finding internships, and even creating opportunities for real world experience in their courses and in small groups on campus. So I think there are lots of ways that students can come in and get engaged.
Even though UWF is a Division II school, athletics is pretty important to the community. I'll give you 2 questions on this. How is dealing with student athletes any different than dealing with students? And do these teams help bring the community together?
Okay, well, 2 things. I've worked with student athletes for years at my previous institutions as well, and I think it's very important to emphasize that they are students first. And so reminding them of the fact that you're here to get an education and to engage fully in that as well as athletics. The other thing is I would say that student athletes are probably some of the hardest working students I've ever seen. I mean, academics are rigorous enough, but when you add to that a training schedule, practices, appearances, games, it just sort of complicates that equation. And so I always admire those students for their dedication. And I think they serve as role models to a lot of our students. Again, it's important that student athletes know the resources available to them and that they utilize those resources as much as possible to be successful. In terms of how athletics influences community, I mean, I think that, you know, it's been a great thing. The football games are the place to be in the fall on the weekends. You know, and I think that it gives students a sense of pride in their institution to be able to cheer for their team and to see their teams do well. So, of course, athletics is a wonderful addition to our campus community and really all the sports. I think, you know, we highlight football, but, you know, basketball, baseball, we have a really good swim team. And then the fact that we've done so well in the championships, that kind of helps things as well.
Do you think it'll be any different once those games are played on campus, whenever that happens?
You know, well, it'll be different because it will bring more outsiders to our campus. And I think that's another piece, especially even in my diversity work. I was amazed as I went around in the community at how many people had never set foot on our campus. And so we are kind of removed from downtown. You know, we're removed from the beach. But at the same time, I think, you know, I know our president is focused on being a destination campus. And so I think bringing athletics to our campus, you know, it's a great opportunity for people to have, to come and admire what we have and to come and explore a little bit more. And so I think it'll only be beneficial in the long run.
Do you have to work with particular students in regard to their immigration status?
Most definitely. So international affairs does fall within my division. And so we do have to work with students to make sure that, you know, they have the appropriate paperwork to be enrolled in the programs. We have to make sure that they maintain that. We have to familiarize them with the rules and requirements to make sure that they're still eligible to stay. And so we have a fabulous Office of International Affairs where the staff is very versed on those topics, and we work with students to do that.
Given the many hats you're wearing right now, what would be something that you do that people would say, really, you do that?
Something that I do. Well, you know, it's really, this is kind of a funny story. I got a few weeks ago, I got a phone call from recreation. And the concern was that we have, students can kayak on the water here on campus. And there was concern because apparently there was an alligator near the dock. And so they wanted to know, what should we do about the alligator? And I thought, never in a million years did I think alligators came with student affairs. But we did work it out. I talked to facilities, and our alligator is a little too small to remove right now, but we had to put up up signage. But again, you know, when you're thinking about a community, this is sort of like a small city. And when it comes to making sure that the students have what they need, you know, we have to make sure that we inform them. And so, you know, you'll be amazed sometimes at the things that'll come up.
Do you have to work with the relationship between students and campus police?
The police don't report to me, but of course on the student side, I do have the dean of students office, so we do handle conduct issues. And on occasion, that is something that we have to navigate. I'm very impressed with the work that Chief is doing on campus to really integrate our officers into the community and to make sure that they develop relationships with our students, because I think that's the important thing, that, you know, the students know that our officers are here to protect them and to that they're a resource as well. And so we're really trying to make sure that we do things to encourage a presence on campus and also encourage our students to interact with the police department.
And I'm sure student safety is a big priority.
Of course. Yes. Not just for students, but for their families as well. I think that's one of the things for orientation. Parents want to know that their kids are safe. And so that's what we want to do, is to make sure that whether they're living on campus, commuting to campus, we want them to know that this campus community is safe for them. And we're also in the process of updating some of our services to make sure that, you know, it's even with technology now, it's amazing some of the things that can be done. And so that will be coming to campus as well and improving student safety.
What have you brought from other places to UWF that you think is enhancing the experience?
Well, I mean, I think that it's I've been a few places before. I've been in other states. And I think that, you know, every campus is unique, but we're all evolving and we're all dynamic. And so that means that things change sometimes. And so I think a lot of times, you know, you experience things in other places. And when you're looking for solutions, sometimes you can pull not just on the memory of what happened in those institutions, but also people that you know who are currently in those roles who may have addressed similar topics. I think it's very helpful to have that network of professionals that you can go to when you need support and you need ideas. I come from faculty, so my background was as a professor, as a department head. And so I think some of the work that we've done with student advising, with tutoring and support services, as a faculty member, very often I could see at the ground level some of the issues that students were dealing with. But the benefit of being an administrator is now that, you know, now I get to allocate resources to address some of those issues. And I think that's probably the most rewarding thing for me. I don't know that the students know I have anything to do with that, but that's really not the important part. The important thing is to see that they're successful in graduating on time.
You're a professor of communications and journalism, right?
That's correct.
I'm not intimidated at all. I expect a good grade from this. What didn't I ask you that people should know?
You know, I think there are a few things. One of the things that I'm very proud of is how we've done in the Board of Governors performance-based metrics this year, that we're in the top three, number two this year. And this was the highest score. We got a 94, which was the highest this year. And I just think that, you know, I credit a lot of that to the work that's being done across campus. If, you know, our faculty and staff didn't get on board and do everything that they could to make it happen, you know, we wouldn't be as successful. And I think that it's been a good exercise for my departments in that it's really encouraged us to look at what we're doing, look at outcomes. And, you know, if there are things that we can do better, we modify and do that. I think the other thing is it's really open lines of communication between faculty and staff. So, you know, making sure that advisors have a chance to talk to one another, making sure that we're a little more intrusive with our students, and that if we see an issue, you know, we don't put the sole responsibility on the student. We want to make sure that they know that they have a team of support here on our campus. And I think that, in all honesty, it's all strengthened our community. And that's really important to me. And I think when I, you know, you asked me about the diversity work that I do, when I really think about it, a lot of it goes back to a lot of the important work that you do as a diversity officer, just sort of building that community and creating spaces for people to engage.
Dr. Kim LaDuff is the Vice President for Academic Engagement and Student Affairs at the University of West Florida. And we're going to stay with the University of West Florida for a bit longer. UWF wants to ensure all students have access to education despite their financial situation. Starting this fall, the university is introducing a new program that will help many students complete their four-year bachelor's degree debt-free. From Station WUWF, Sandra Eberhardt reports.
The program is called Argo 30 Guarantee.
The promise to our undergraduate Florida resident Pell-eligible students that they will not have any out-of-pocket costs for their tuition and fees for up to 30 credit hours for the academic year.
Shayna Gore is Executive Director of UWF Enrollment Management, which is overseeing the program. Gore says the Argo 30 Guarantee is the first of its kind at UWF and is the result of a collaborative effort to assist the university's neediest students.
You know, sometimes families have some funds saved, and so getting through the first semester, the first year, isn't necessarily the issue, but then they'll be talking to their academic advisor and we find out that they are withdrawing because of the cost as a barrier for them.
The program is limited to tuition and fees, not covered by other grants or scholarships, up to 30 credit hours each academic year for up to 4 years. Gore explains.
There could be additional charges if students elect to live on campus or if students elect for a meal plan. Of course, there's costs for books, even transportation if they're driving back and forth from home. And there may be some other programs to assist with that. But the tuition and fees, every student has to pay those regardless of where you live, what your meal plan situation is. So that's the part that we want to make sure is covered.
As noted, to qualify for the Argo 30 Guarantee, students must be classified as Pell-eligible Florida residents seeking their first bachelor's degree and meet application deadlines. The new program is expected to provide a significant benefit at UWF, where approximately 35% to 40% of all in-state undergraduate students qualify as Pell-eligible. And approximately the same percentage of 2019 incoming freshmen from Escambia County qualify for Pell grants.
And I think for a lot of our Escambia County students, this could be the difference in whether they're able to attend college or not. Pell grant is a need-based grant, and it does cover a portion of the tuition and fees. But even for those students that qualify for the highest amount of Pell, they still fall a couple hundred dollars short.
For example, for students taking 15 hours per semester at UWF, the annual cost is $6,360. The Pell Grant maximum is just over $6,100. The difference could be greater for students who qualify for less Pell Grant funds.
We're just going to make that promise that they can come here, they'll use the Pell Grant. Sometimes they have other need or merit-based aid, but whatever that gap is, UWF will make sure it's covered so that they can just worry about going to school.
On this day, UWF student Hunter Lyons and fellow orientation leaders have been conducting orientation with some of UWF's newest students. As they wrap up their lunch break in the Commons, Lyons is getting a bit of the star treatment after speaking with the media just minutes before about the new Argo 30 Guarantee program.
Just being able to not worry about your finances and just focus on growth and like learning what you want to do, I think is wonderful.
Lyons is the kind of student the Argo 30 Guarantee was created for. The graduate of Pine Forest High School is an information technology major, now heading into his junior year at UWF. After the death of one of his parents, he spent much of his childhood in foster care.
I think especially for students like me who were in foster care, or maybe they don't have a good relationship with their parents, or they just don't receive financial support for their parents, Pell Grant and other financial aid like the Argo 30 Guarantee are incredibly helpful because that's what's going to let them buy a car. That's what's going to let them get ahead in life so they can get where they need to be.
Lyons graduated high school a year early. With assistance, he's tapped into all the financial resources that are available to him, and he's making the most of his time at UWF, including plans to pursue a master's degree.
I'd like to study student affairs, which is this.
He points to the green staff shirt he's wearing as a representative of the Office of Undergraduate Admissions.
I work as an orientation leader here, so we basically teach new students how to be an adult. And I'd like to do that in the long term. I don't know if I'd work in orientation or maybe recruitment, something to that degree. But as an IT major, it's been wonderful.
Additionally, Lyons is in student government, and he started the UWF Gaming Club, the biggest club on campus with some 400 members. It appears his future is bright, on track to finish college debt-free.
I am already looking at buying a house. That wouldn't even be on the horizon if with tens of thousands of dollars of debt.
Other students are not so lucky, graduating with varying amounts of debt from student loans. In 2019, student debt reached $1.5 trillion nationwide. For students eligible for the Argo 30 guarantee, UWF wants to reduce or even eliminate that kind of financial burden. Again, Enrollment Management Director Shana Gore.
We don't want a student having to make a decision to either not attend UWF if that's where they feel is the best fit for them, or in many cases not attend college at all because of the cost barrier.
The Argo 30 guarantee will launch this fall, with incoming eligible students automatically considered if they complete the FAFSA. Resources used for the program will come from a variety of sources, requiring no repayment.
And that story comes to us from Sandra Everhart at WUWF Radio. Still to come, we stay in the Sunshine State, where school districts will soon be required to provide instruction on mental health issues. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. With unanimous approval by the State Board of Education, public schools in Florida will be required to teach students about mental health issues. The new program is called Hope for Healing, and it mandates at least 5 hours of instruction in grades 6 through 12 each school year. It stems from a recent listening tour around the state led by First Lady Casey DeSantis, who says it's grown beyond just a collaboration of state agencies.
And I think it's imperative that we go in this direction in a sense that we work with our private partners. We want to make sure that those people who want to do good things know how they can help make a difference by joining the Hope for Healing initiative.
School administrators proposed the change to the statewide curriculum last month, following discussions with the First Lady, who has made mental health one of her top priorities.
What I realized very quickly is that I wanted to take a step back and listen, and I wanted to see where we could do things to make a meaningful impact. And very quickly, I realized that mental health and substance abuse was one of those key areas.
The approach being taken towards these two areas, says DeSantis, is similar to the way she and her husband look at environmental issues.
This is an investment in the people of this state. Making sure that they're getting meaningful help and good outcomes is only going to pay off in major dividends, not only for their well-being, but also from a monetary perspective when we look at people and contributing to the state and the economy. It's just the right thing to do, just like the environment.
We recognize CPR saves lives, but proper mental health training will save lives. We've already secured, and we're pending right now, 30-day approval for $2 million grant from the federal government for the Hope for Healing program to create that mental awareness and get that word out.
State Education Secretary Richard Corcoran worked with the First Lady to draw up the new rule after taking part in the listening tour.
We want every single child not only to graduate with a world-class education, but to be stable and ready for all those challenges and obstacles that they're going to face in the course of their lifetime, and that they've been trained and they know how to overcome those obstacles, push through, and persevere in a society that can be very, very difficult.
School districts will be able to choose the types of courses that will be taught, but there remains a lot of gray area when it comes to implementation. According to Malcolm Thomas, he's the school superintendent for Escambia County, Florida.
The way it's worded in the rule, it's pretty broad. It's everything from actual mental health issues that kids might face, and that in itself is broad, to bullying, to cyberbullying. What we're going to try to figure out over the next few weeks is the timeline. Is it going to happen this year?
There are other questions to be answered, according to Thomas, including qualifications of those who provide the instruction, along with how to put together the 5-hour curriculum.
So we'll have to work with the Department of Education and our own subject area specialists to figure out and define what is meant in those 5 hours instruction. I actually think on this, since it's only 5 hours, it would probably become incorporated into an existing class.
Mental health assistance in schools is essential, contends Thomas, To that end, the Escambia County School District has partnered with a local mental health facility, the Lakeview Center, to offer outpatient help for students and families for the past 2 decades.
But with the allocation that the legislature gave us last year, we were able to put licensed mental health counselors on every campus, elementary, middle, and high school. And so we're not sure if that's the group that's going to deliver instruction, if it's going to be a part of some other existing class, which would be an easy thing to do.
One more question is how the program will be paid for. Funds for the program will come from $75 million that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis allocated to the mental health assistance allocation for Florida schools in his 2020 budget. Well, since we're spending the show in Florida, you know, eventually we'd be heading underwater. And that's where we'll find the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Ecosystems are complicated and have surprising interconnections. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Cliff Ross, an associate professor of biology at the University of North Florida, is studying mosquitoes in order to survey the health of coral reefs.
Since the 1970s, coral reefs around the globe have declined by over 50% due to human activities such as pollution and climate change. When corals reproduce, they release tiny larvae into the water column. These newborn corals float around at the mercy of the currents for hours to months. This floating existence is a critical time point for corals, as they can be exposed to many different types of stressors. Why is this important? If the larvae don't live, then you won't have adults. Pesticide exposure is one such type of stressor. In the Florida Keys, larval release not only coincides with seasonal rains, but also coincides with the hatching and development of mosquitoes. In order to better understand the effects of pesticides and temperatures on coral larvae, we used individuals from Parietes asteroides. Following exposure, survival and settlement were measured. We also quantified sublethal stress in the larvae by using unique cellular assays. These assays work much like a blood test in humans, where you can identify if an individual is sick and to what extent. While our results suggest that some larvae may have a moderate degree of resistance against short-term exposure to ecologically relevant concentrations of pesticides, the results are far from being clear-cut. Results were variable and dependent upon the pesticide type, the temperature used, and the type of biomarker being examined. In the ocean, where so many stressors can interact, our work is significant in that it serves as a warning to other scientists. What's the warning? When dealing with cases of multiple stressors, things can get quite complex and differential responses can be encountered. We still have a lot to learn about corals.
That was Cliff Ross of the University of North Florida. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.